So we got a question? Shmuel, you had a key, right?
Oh, alright. I have my question.
Yeah, come in. I thought I heard a knocking. It's not.
I have a question. You guys did.
Okay,
so, system represents basically how you should live your life as a person. And if you don't, if you're not familiar with the mitzvos, then you should be embarrassed just as a ben adam. You don't. So okay. It's saying if you look at the mitzvos, then that's the method of not being evosh.
Through looking at the mitzvos, you'll learn about how to live or something like that, and then you'll be embarrassed.
So then, if you have that idea, so it makes sense. It'll be at in the front of Mishnah Torah because the Mishnah Torah is. The halacha code is exactly how to follow the mitzvahs. That's like a very brief.
Yeah, I think he said also. I think there's another dimension to it, which was that the. I mean, he asked the question like, what does it mean that a person's going to be like embarrassed? Like, I forgot how the question came up, but the. So like, no one knows all of the mitzvahs. You know, no one can do it all. Like, you do the grace of fun.
Right.
And fill every single mitzvah. The ultimate degree. So you're embarrassed that you didn't fulfill everything. So he said, right, the man is a philosophical embarrassment. Means when you understand the whole system of all the mitzvahs and everything interplays and all that, then you'll like that's like the highest level a person can reach, I guess, or something like that. And to the extent that you're lacking in that, albeit that's impossible to reach the ultimate level, but to the extent that you're lacking. That's a real embarrassment. That's a true embarrassment.
Uh-huh. What like, show is this? What tape is this, do you know?
It's called... I got it on my phone.
Were you listening to this recently?
What?
You listened to it recently or something?
Yeah. Whatever. It was in the last few months.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I must have too. Because I also remember that point that you just brought up. Came back.
I don't remember that show. Is that the subject this year about this pasuk, or it just came up in passing?
No, I think it was like a brief thing at the beginning.
No,
I think it was
something. Wasn't it was a part of Ethics of Avraham or something, right?
It wasn't that. It was part of, I think, the two parts. I'll have to talk this year.
Okay, you let me know. Yeah, so you could listen to that show.
I was asking about, the question came up about, so to start off, it was about how do you, like, about why he asked the question, like how do you analyze mitzvos like mitzora? About why, like Torahs, like you're trying to understand.
Really? Wow.
Something like that.
I don't think I've heard that one.
I'll
let you know.
Okay, you can post it. Yeah, okay, so I don't have anything to say about that, but they sound like that's a good show to listen to if you're interested.
What show was this?
Okay, good question. Good question. Okay. Next.
So, my question was, based on a discussion I was having with someone, they brought to my attention that at certain times in Gemara and in Halacha, the Halacha will be determined by, let's say, like one of the 13 principles, or you know, something of that nature, like Zereshchevo, or... And my question is, if we say, really, that the Torah approach is to be, like, it's like a rational system. You have to work things out through logic, and you have, like, a reasonable thing. So then, how could it be that a resolution to thing will end in just, oh, you know, like, this guy holds this opinion, that guy holds that opinion, and what is the thing in the end? Zereshchevo shows us that it's his way. It seems like to be against reason.
Do you object to the Yigil Midos altogether, or just to then determining Psak? Like resolving a machlokes?
I think both. I don't understand why resolution should come about through using those Midos and not...
Well, what about just not learning halachos using Yigil Midos? You understand why halachos should be resolved using Midos? Like, there's no halachos supposed to be rational, so what's the idea of using Yigil Midos to figure out halachos?
Yeah, I guess so. It's interesting that things could be derived that way when... It doesn't appear to be based on like a rational like a spara or something, like a definition.
Right. Okay. Good question. Yeah, go ahead.
How would you derive something? I don't understand how you derive something. Let me
give the example this person showed me. They weren't using it for this purpose, but so it's about the halacha of osa besbeno. You can't shech the an animal and its child on the same day. So the pasuk says biyom echad,
right.
And the Gemara asks, what does it mean biyom echad? Does it mean, let's say the because nafkamina case would be, let's say you shecht the animal at night. So can you shecht the sun the next day?
Right.
So it depends how you define day.
Right.
If the day starts at night, then no. But if the day starts in the morning, like a day of carbon, then yes. So the Gemara resolves that it uses a Zereshchevo. Because by Sabratius it says, by Yerav Vayivoker Yom Echad.
Right.
Same Lashon. So it said, so you see it's nighttime starts it.
Mm-hmm. How would you have preferred it to have been derived?
Well, the point is, you had two logical possibilities there.
Okay.
And the resolution was simply, let's go by Zereshchevo.
Okay. So, what's your answer, Matt?
I was saying, how would you have preferred it as a direct, like just like in the abstract, what does day mean? Command, something like that?
I don't know. You have those two possibilities, and then maybe let's say,
what I'm saying, but isn't what you're doing over there just basically saying that here's an instance of where, we're showing you exactly what you're looking for. Like, this is how it is over here. Why shouldn't we...
Right, but he's saying it's like, there's nothing to say that that intrinsically that the way the day is used in Maaseh Bereishis has to be the same way it's used in Osa Vespa. No, it's because of the mechanism of Zereshchevo.
Why can't we say that Zereshchevo is the most rational way to figure that problem out?
Okay. Fine.
Like,
all
the Midos would be like the most rational way to figure out a problem.
Okay, but Shmuel thinks it's not really rational, right? That's your question? Doesn't seem very rational. Like, it's a good approach, but you got to defend that a little bit, because it doesn't sound too rational, right? That's where you're coming from, Shmuel, right? Sounds pretty superficial. It says over here, says over there, blah, 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 right?
I guess I'm not sure if it would be similar, but, like, let's say in Psak, you say, we'll go by rote. So is that... Meaning, just practically, I guess you have to have rules in terms of Psak. Not like Rove is definitely...
Right, correct. But I don't think... that's what I think you may be making a mistake here. It's like, I don't really see this as a question of resolving a dispute or not. If you buy the mechanism of Yigil Midos as a method of whatever it does in Halal and Torah, deriving halachos, then it could be a Srapsach, because it's a legitimate, rational, halachic method like anything else.
Right.
It's just you're saying it's not legitimate. If it's not legitimate, then it should never be legitimate, you know? But given that it is a legitimate mechanism, then of course you can pass with it. Why shouldn't you have pass with it? You can do anything, you know? It's one of the mechanisms of the Talmud Torah. You know what I mean? So I don't see it as Psak. Yeah, Rove could be used in different contexts, and also, you know, that just whatever mechanism will work, Psak is, you know, I mean, maybe there are certain differences, but I, you know, it seems to me your question is more that you don't really see the logic of the principle altogether.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Okay. Well, is there more to Zereshchevo than just like what we see it as like, oh, Tesvav, Tesvav. Mm-hmm. Like, or is, you know, or is there a
deeper idea within a Xer Shava, or?
Good question. Good question. So, yeah, anyone else? Anyone have any suggestions? Yes?
I mean, I thought that Xer Shava was not just like, because it says the same words here, we're going to learn this, we're going to learn it out the same way. I mean, it is that, but I'm saying it's basically what you call, you're bringing another text to support your way of reading.
Right.
Meaning you're saying, over here, it says the same words, and it's read this way. Right. Uh-huh. So that should be a proof that over here, we should read it the same way.
Right, I understand.
I mean, that's like a logical. That seems logical.
Right.
I mean, because we do it all the time in other areas.
Uh-huh.
Like, even in like a manuscript, let's say, not in Hebrew. Like in a regular manuscript, you would bring writings from that era, and you would show how a lot of people wrote this way. That was a common way to write. And so you would say that we should read it this way.
Is that how Xer Shava really is? Like, they're using the limud of a pasuk to learn that two things are connected.
Right, like the word yom appears many times. In, I mean, there's a thing, is like, I think Xer Shava, it's a machlokes v'adid yomidos, but I think Xer Shava, everyone holds, you need a besora to be darsh and Xer Shava. You can't just find any time the word yom appears. There's a besora that there's a Xer Shava here between these two words. I think what the substance of Xer Shava is subject to dispute, but I think you can't just pick two words and like, that is a method of like, you want to figure out what Rama means when he says potter, so you look at the power, whatever, something like that. But I mean, Xer Shava is a particular mechanism which is based upon a Masorah. But the other one, I think it's a Machlok. I think that everyone agrees Xer Shava. You know them done Xer Shava Me'atzma. Can't make up your own Xer Shava. As everyone agrees, you could do Kal V'chomer on your own. And I think the other Yigam Yidus is a Machlok. I believe Rashi tells us whether the Dag Yidus needs a Masorah or not.
You mean
the Xer Shavas
are from Moshe?
Yes.
Right.
Okay. Yes, Masorah. Yes, so this is basically what I was going to say to your question. Is that first of all, I guess, is that there's two svaras left. Let's say there's two svaras in the area. Okay, but also that's what I know. You don't know what I mean. What's the law? You know. Now, you don't necessarily know. Well, which one did the God mean? And it says Yom. So is there any way we could know what Hashem meant when he set up that Esser? So I mean, I guess you could try to figure it out. In the svara, it's possible. I guess. But I think it means the Torah was given with the Yigam Lamidos as a method of being Dorish. And it was when God wrote the Torah, he, so to speak, encoded the halachic system into the Torah Shel Tzav via Yigam Lamidos, which is a system which God gave to man to use his Chachma to apply the system and to use, you know, all the Lamidos and all the intricacies of the Lamidos. And they could use that system and that Chachma of the system, which we don't currently, you know, we don't have access to all the facets of it, to derive halachos. So you could figure out what God meant or what God wants to mean when he says Yom Echad based upon the Yigam Lamidos. So that is like, so to speak, like it's like a code book. Like what is God, it's almost like you have a word. What does the word mean? So you figure out what the word means. So what did God mean when he said that word? What did he mean when he says tefillin? So you have a Masorah, what it says, you know, you gotta rationally figure it out. You have to figure out what did God mean when he said tefillin. So you have to check it out in the Masorah. So one way God gives us a Sur Masorah, another way is Sur Yigam Lamidos. That the Torah was written in a way that God built in all the Yigam Lamidos. Every word is carefully measured, such that, and this is amazing, because you have the whole wealth of Torah Shebaal Peh, all the Sigmaras galore. You have Torah Shebaal Tzav, a small, plain, easily read book, but encoded into the Torah Shebaal Tzav, and a vav here, and an s here, and a little thing there, and a little thing there, and all these different things. And these 13 principles, or whatever, maybe additional principles, basically, you could arrive at the conclusions of the, you know, of the Torah Shebaal Peh. And that's how God wrote the Torah. And there's a chachma to figuring that out. So there might be two different svaras, but the question isn't always which svara did God mean when he set up halacha. You can have a great svara in tefillin, but it may not be the svara that God wanted, so to speak. You know, this is svara which the mitzvah actually has. So the way we figure it out is based upon Masorah, svara, Yigam Lamidos. You know, that's all part of what God told us to do, to figure out what the proper halachas are. You know what I mean? Yeah. Is there any question?
So is that like a similar thing that Vypsovky would say wrote? Like that's just simply...
I would think so. I mean, I'm not sure, maybe Rove, I guess, there's Akramatos. Yeah, Akramatos is a mitzvah in the Torah. Right. I think it's on the Hayag. But it says, and you have a Bazdan, let's end up Sak Bazdan. So you have a Bazdan, you have a Sanhedrin, they want to be Paskin Halacha. So the Torah says, go by Rove. That's a method of arriving at a truth of a particular halachic decision. And that's what we've been now, but that's maybe a little different, maybe it's the same, but that's like just in a particular shayla, so you're going to have many different chachamim coming to different opinions. And the Torah holds that there's an idea of having a basin, not just having a lot of term by one person, or at certain times it is, whenever it's appropriate to have shlosha, or 23, or however many it is. And the way to arrive at the truth is, the best method man has arriving at the truth is based on a rov, or that's a good, very, very good method. Because he was a lot of chachamim, and how are you going to figure out, you know, how's Klai Yisrael or a group of people going to figure out who to follow? So rov is a smart way to do it. Right.
Sammy's question, though, I think. That seems like a sensible way of determining.
That seems sensible. Yeah, well, that's the same. That's a different type of question. See, that's why I say it's not exactly the same thing, because that's when you have.
If you decided between the two definitions of yom,
yeah, right, like take a row. I know, but I think the thing is that if you have,
I'm just gonna call it something that would make sense. I don't really know how
right,
you figure it out, but
right. But I think the thing is if that's what God set up, that's how He told you what yom means. Let's say God said yom and I mean yom of this, and you wouldn't say, well, can you give me the svara? I don't know. What you can you give me the svara? But that's what He meant, and God's telling you what He meant. So that's the right svara now. Now, if God's telling you what He meant, if you're going to need those to tell you this, let's say it's Masorah, to make a Gershav between Yom and Yom. Let's say it's actually Masorah in that particular one. So God's telling you, I mean, this Yom, that's the Yom I mean. You know, and let's say there's no particular Masorah on this particular Gomidos. But God knew all the Gomidos, and He gave the book in a way that's how He wanted to figure out all of them. So that's what He goes to figure out. What did He really mean? What's the Sfarah that God's going for? Is the Sfarah which is arrived at through a combination of Dosh Rosav and the Gomidos. You know, but of course, it has to be a good idea. If it's not a good idea, I mean, you have to figure out the svara, figure out what the idea is. But if you want to be mavara between two different svaras, it would be if you could ask God which one did He mean. So you don't need this to sort of be a good method of transmitting to us which one He meant. You know, it could be sometimes in the Yomidas themselves there is an idea alluded to. I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, maybe you'd say, for instance, the concept of Yosef Espino is based upon appreciation of the Bria Solon, and it's therefore it's supposed to come there. So I don't know, so perhaps there's a svara like that. You know, like it could be sometimes you don't need those actually points to ideas. You know? Like it's not clear. Is there sort of a bowl of like just an empty like thing, or is there a svara in there? So in fact, so it's an equation between Kicha Kicha and Mistaf when it tells you Kiddush and the Kassaf. Maybe it tells you something about Kiddush. Kenyan, it's not just a technical, you know. So sometimes it could be their Sheva has like, you know, you'd have to learn that Sigya. You get two Svaras, but it could be that would, you know, the Svara of saying it goes by a Yarva Vukha, that's what it's saying, it goes by like, by Sibaratius. Something with, I don't know what the Svara would be, but perhaps there's a, you know, further idea.
You're saying there's a Chachma to deriving Halachos through these methods.
Right, it would be like logical rules and like axioms and like logical inferences you make from the system. Or you give the axioms and you derive, like it's a particular geometry. There's the axioms and then you derive all this stuff from all this, you know. So it's like the axioms with which you read the Torah. How do you read the Torah? How do you figure out what God meant? So He didn't write everything out. He didn't write a massive book that has all the particulars written out. Rather, He wrote a short book and gave you these axioms of so fly and reading it. But the chachma of blindness.
So those axioms, they are, you know, certain structures, but they don't have to be, like, intuitive.
No, right, exactly. Right, they don't have to be a logical principle. It's a principle by which God wrote the book. It would be as if someone wrote a book and says, whenever there's an aleph, so shefer beis. Like in theory, if you write a rule, that's the way it's encoded. You know? So he's saying is, like, klal, let's say a mamatzin. Like binyanav is a means, and you have basically a category, and God tells you a particular halacha which applies to one particular of the category. You have a right to generalize it to the entire category. So that's the way God wrote the Torah. He didn't spell every detail out in every single member of the category, but He wrote it that it lends itself to generalizing. there's different types of books. You could write a book that lends over generalizing, or you find a book that spells out everything in particular, saying that God wrote the book in a way that you have a right to generalize. Now, logically, do you have to write a book like that? No, this is the way God wrote Torah. He wrote Torah, that way he told us this is how he wrote Torah. You have a right to generalize, unless other indications or whatever, you have a right to generalize. So it's like, it's not a necessary logical principle, but it is like a way of conveying ideas. God is conveying us ideas through the book and these principles of inference. You know? Even Kal Vachomer, I think, isn't. I don't think Kal Vachomer, but my opinion is Kal Vachomer isn't like a purely logical mechanism. It's based upon a meta principle that sort of contends to be Dorosh and Kal Vachomer. But that's it. Yeah. So it's like, there is a logic to it, but it's because God wrote the Torah that he encoded halachas in the Torah, which through the mechanism of Kal Vachomer. You know that God wrote it that way, you wouldn't be able to, you can't take Kal Vachomer and learn out the rules of physics from Kal Vachomer. You know, it just doesn't work that way. If you see some Kal Vachomer, it just doesn't add up. But with the given that that's how God wrote the Torah, then it does add up. So I think that you have to look at it as like that, rules of derivation of like, through which God conveyed us many halachos in a very small book. It is amazing when you think about that. Like you see how big Shas is and how small the Torah is. And you see sugyas and you see how much information is in. You see like a sugya which goes through every single word in a pasuk. You know, you see how the whole Torah was written that way. It's like astounding to imagine how that's all in the book, you know? Yeah. And that same book, like reads a plain person, just reads the Torah and it's like a popular book and you're just reading the plain story. You know, not even know anything is there beneath the surface.
Yeah, like this whole Gemara is like Hanuman, that it's a whole discussion about like there's a phrase that trying to some contradiction that says like one place achas and this is another place ve'achas.
Yeah.
And this whole discussion about me'achas, not ve'achas.
Right.
About how how is that you're doing part that is like about Shabbos? So how is it that is this a chayav for doing part of the malacha? Is it also a chayav for doing the whole thing?
Yeah, exactly.
Just because it says that meh.
Exactly, right. Exactly. But you don't notice it at all. It's like the book, it reads like a plain, imagine like a plain novel, easily read book, you know? But then you see beneath the surface, there's like, you know, this is an example. It's like if you take a book, let's say a physics book, let's say like from your classes now, like an advanced physics book, and then you take a book like Physics for Dummies, or in any subject, law for Dummies, you know, the two books are so different. You can't write one book that's going to talk to the brilliant people in the area, the experts, and also just a plain simple person. How do you do that? It's just totally different, you know. But it's like in the Torah Shvasav is a book which talks to every person. The Bible is like the best-selling book ever, you know. It just talks to everybody, and at the same time, it has encoded in it the big, greatest depth for the greatest chacham of you know. They never cease to gain more and more ideas and insights from the book of the Torah. You know, it's all. This is the book which God gave us at Sinai. You know, it's like amazing to think about. You know, God pulled that off. The infinite chachma woven into this book, which at the same time there was like Lashem Adam, and it's just like a plain, the main record is Lipshuto. You know, you never know, and any one pasuk, you pull up all the wisdom from that one pasuk, it's amazing, you know, and it still reads like the normal, you know, plain pshat. Yeah, it is amazing. But that's, he was able to do that based upon Yod Yomidus. That was like the mechanism by which he did it, is that there's you know, and to make a consistent system, 13 principles, or I don't know, maybe there are more, but whatever, a few principles with which you could derive the wealth of halachos, for, you know, the Torah Baal Peh from this book, is, you know, and they're always consistent, you know, and they end up resulting in all the proper, you know, things, and if there doesn't, then there's a meal, which still the other don't apply, yeah, but, you know, it's like, you know, mind-boggling to think of Yeah.
It's not really possible to define all the Gimel Midos, because we don't know how they work.
Yeah, I guess not. But, you know, but you do sigils on them, you start getting a feel. I mean, I've done different sigils, various ones, and, like, you may not define all the intricacies, you know, the whole system, but you kind of get a feel, like, the idea of Vinyanov. It's, like, ideas, those written in a way that you could generalize. It doesn't write a particular, but, it, you know, you have a right to generalize. You know, that's in a loose type of sense, you know? So, like, you could give loose ideas or senses of what these numeritos are. I mean, you have to, like, you know, if you do a sugya on them, it's, like, interesting to pay attention to them, and you get it, you start, like, in any sugya, you start getting a feel for what's the principles operating in the sugya, so we, ultimately, we don't know the system, we can't do it, but I don't think that means you can't get anything from it. It's interesting, it's always interesting, because it's, like, it's not, you're not, and this maybe was bothering you, Shmuel, it's, like, it's not, you're not really, it's not ideas and chachma about the sugya itself. But it's chachma in conveying ideas via a text. And the transition of having how a text could portray ideas, convey ideas, through a mechanisms of inference, you know, principles of inference, or, you know, the fixed principle, you know. So that's an interesting type of, it's very similar, it could be similar to, like, Euclidean geometry almost, you know, if you understood the principles. It's like you have, start with these five axioms, and then you have a wealth of, you know, theorems upon theorems upon theorems, all just like following good reasoning and these principles, you know. So it's the reasoning, it's based upon the axioms, so you have to have the axiom, that axiom is the whole thing false, and nothing is nothing. So these are like the axioms which you read in Torah, but everything is based upon this, the assumption of the truth of the axioms. So these are the axioms with which God wrote the Torah. And this is the way he meant to convey ideas to you.
Right. The only difference is there, the axioms themselves are basically the root ideas.
In there.
In Euclid.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess so. You mean there's ideas in the axioms? Sort of. That's sort of.
I feel like they make sense, at least.
Yeah, it depends how you mean by make sense. I guess so.
They're like
in a certain sense. But they, look, they, you know, you could change the fifth axiom and it could make something else. There's three different versions of it. So you could...
Very intuitive, I guess.
Yeah, sort of. Well, there's an intuitive... Well, it depends what you mean by that. Like, this idea of generalizing, of Vinyanov. You do the Torah also. The idea of Vinyanov makes sense. It's intuitive, but... What? I think they do. I think that makes sense. It depends what you mean by make sense. There is a sense to them. I don't think they're necessary. But there's a sense to them. But neither are the axioms.
But they're tools. These things are tools. But the axioms are, you want to have those and then derive from them.
Yes, but they could have been different. Like, it turns out that axiom, that's the fifth axiom, is they change that thing of a distance in a straight line. A parallel line never meet at one point. They never intersect. Yes, yeah, so you change that axiom, and you end up with a whole different thing. So there's certain, but this is the axiom we're going with, so to speak. Now, if you don't do Euclidean geometry, you're going with that axiom. Now, you want to change to a different axiom, you end up with different conclusions. So this is it's a little different. It's not exactly the same thing, but I'm just saying that this is the axiom with which God wrote the Torah. He could have written a different Torah, and then he would have had everything would be different. But this is the axiom with which he did it. Now, is there a logic why this is the right way, this is the right one and not the other one? I mean, this is the way which God wanted to encode all these halachos. I don't know if there's like an intrinsically it's the best principle, but it's the best principle, it's the principle by which God is conveying to us the halachic system. Could you have done it if you would have changed the axiom? What?
That's when those axioms seem more arbitrary, you know?
See, what I'm saying is the idea is the purpose of the axioms are for God to convey to us these conclusions.
Could have been done in any way, though.
It could be, but it could be these are the best ways to convey to us these ideas. I don't know if you could say, could God have, if you would have changed the axiom to something else, and now say, God, rewrite the Torah with changing it to anti-Vinyanov. Would he be able to do that? I don't know. Maybe this is the best way to convey these ideas. I don't know if you have to say that there's intrinsically this is the best, this is like a proper way of thinking. I don't know if you've taken it in enough and now apply it to physics. I don't know if that would be a legitimate step to make. But apply like Svara thinking and go to physics and say it's good because it's just pure thinking. Apply good definitions and good logical deductive reasoning or whatever. You can apply those things to the universe or to anything. But this is just a method.
If you want to come with principles on which how to encode information in a book. I don't know if you've come to anything.
I don't know if you've come to anything. I don't know if there's a principle to it. I think it's sort of an arbitrariness to that. What?
It's like the wrong
sensible thing to say.
I would think these are sensible. I just think that if you have to learn to think about them, you'll see they're sensible. It depends what you mean. I think it's an option. I don't think you come to this as the only way to encode principles, but I don't think there is a logic to it. It's a matter of, in a certain sense, it's a matter of convention. How are you going to convey information?
That's convention. I don't think like Euclidean geometry is convention.
No, you're fine. But this, I think that's, this type of thing is convention.
Yeah. Isn't it similar to like what the Rambam says about like which animal is for a certain karma? I mean, it had to be a certain animal. So if it was the other animal, you'd ask, why isn't it that animal?
Right.
Yeah, no.
But it's certainly like, you know, it's certainly reasonable to, we don't know anything about this, certainly reasonable to say these are the best axioms by which to to convey the greatest amount of information in a small amount of space, or something like that. But, you know, that's too big a question to ask. Why these?
Right.
You know, but I'm just saying this is what they are. The goal is not to question why they are, but to take them as givens. Yinimishat Torah and Nidrashos. Well, that's what they are. The principles of which the Torah is Nidrash with. You know, I mean, that's what the Torah was given to us. It was given to us with these. You're going to need those, and this is how the Torah was meant to be Nidrash. How are we supposed to learn the Torah using these principles?
So what does it mean that we don't know how to apply them anymore?
I think we just don't know, like, the intricacies of the mechanisms. So, like, we don't know all the rules of them.
Right.
You know, and like, I don't know if they're just, like, purely mechanical principles. It could be there's a degree of svara built into them. Like, sometimes you know, I don't know if you can just apply them to the rule book, for example. Could be there's a degree of like swara, block. Not every principle has to be like clear cut. Like it could be when two things are similar, then you say it's for the Kershaw when they're not similar.
There's arguments about
them. What? Yeah, the arguments about them and when you say them, and you know, so it's all system, and I just think that no one knows ins and outs of how they work. So you could try, but I don't think that means you can't understand them a little bit when you do this. So yes, you know, you kinda get a feel for how they work a little bit.
And that's really interesting that a rabbi will say, like, in the Gemara, oh, I learned out this thing from here, and then someone else will say, no, that's not, we don't.
Right, well, oftentimes you say you didn't have a Masorah. You say, because Yerushalayim said you didn't have the Masorah from his rabbi, so then you can't have, can't be Dorish called Yerushalayim on your own. That's one thing. But, yeah, sometimes he's Dorish a Pasuk a different way. He'll climb the Mahalik. I mean, oh, what does he do with this Pasuk? He uses it for this, he uses it for that, you know. So there's a certain amount of seems like there's an amount of leeway about how to use them, and how, you know, it's not, they're not exactly like so clear cut like Euclidean's axioms or whatever. Just, you know, deductive logic. There's a certain amount of svara going on in them also, I think. So we just don't know, you know, way we don't know how to do the whole. We don't know how to do it.
Like it should always result in a svara after you do the
therapy. Yes. Right. Correct. But what I'm saying is, even the matter of, it could be judgment calls about whether the derivative, whether it's appropriate to apply them or not.
Right.
You know, like, let's say maybe in law, you could have, like, certain legal, you know, principles by which you could derive laws from one, you know, case to another case. But it's a matter of judgment of a particular judge or a lawyer about whether it's appropriate to apply a given principle in a case or not. So you may know what the principle is, but its application may be a matter of, you know, maybe a matter of svara. Intuition, whether it's appropriate or not. I don't know. It says it could be that's an element in the system. It's, you know, it's not as, you know, clear cut as, you know. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, good question. Really interesting. Yeah. Joey.
Yeah. How are you supposed to look at things like other,
Bible codes?
Like Bible codes. Different things that people like look to when they I think it's other examples. Bible codes to me is like one good example of like...
Prove the Torah is true.
What?
To prove the Torah is true.
Prove the Torah is true, or are these things real? Is it like a coincidence? Is it just like a sort of like a Gematria thing? Or is it, how are you supposed to approach things like that?
What are these things?
Torah codes, I mean, I don't know if there's a general rule for all these things, but Torah codes in theory, they claim. I think this is met with skepticism amongst mathematicians, and the mathematicians have supported it. It's like all a big, you know, area. I don't know what the bottom line is. But they claim that if you, like, there's all kinds of codes in, built into the Torah. Like, if you take the 47th letter, every 47th letter, or the 48th letter, it says the state of Israel will be founded in the year 48. I don't know. Like, there's, like, these crazy codes that they have. Like, they claim that in the Torah, you can do these things, and there's, like, patterns which emerge, which predict the future, and talk about things, and whatever, more so than any other book. Other people say, no, you take Shakespeare, you do the same thing. You'll say, no, you can't do Shakespeare. You'll say, well, Hebrew you can do it, because in Hebrew the letters is much easier to form words out of Hebrew. And, you know, I don't know. It's like a whole question, but they show you all these things. So it has to be true, because look, the Torah predicted so-and-so, and you do this method, and, you know. And they call them the Torah codes. The Eshel Torah has a big thing about it. There are books about it. They have in mathematical papers written discussing the merits. I have a book about it, actually. My brother does, and my parents have to be interested in reading about it. I'm not that interested in reading about it, but I haven't really read much about it. But it's, you know, I don't know. It sounds funny to me, the whole thing.
I'm just wondering, position that we take on something like that?
Well, I mean, there's one thing is, if you really want first of all, I would be skeptical about the statistical significance of the thing.
They found everything after the
event. Yeah, right. It's like, you know, I've had some experience with the statistics, let's say with stocks or something. It's very easy to find patterns and things after the fact, which aren't real. Yeah, so, you know, like, I don't know if you could find, you find a lot of patterns, they don't mean anything, you know. But you'd have to really check the statistical significance of it. Like, I'd say if the numbers pan out, which, again, I would be doubtful, but if they pan out that there's something to it, I don't know if it's funny to say that proves that it's from God. Like, I don't know. It's like we don't have a Torah that there's such a thing like that, that God encoded, I don't know, things into Torah in that type of a way. So what's the claim? That it must be the Torah's divine, because how else could it have these codes in it? It's not the Torah's claiming that it has these codes in it anywhere. So I just feel like, what's the, you know, I just don't get it. It's not that compelling to me. I can't imagine someone's going to believe in Torah because something like that. You know, I don't know.
Is it different than some, like, gematria? I mean, like, is it?
Yeah, I don't know what gematria is. I mean, gematria, yeah, I guess that's what gematria is. Yeah, Chaim, you don't know.
So, right, I'll ask your question. Ask, what? What do you do with the Baal HaTorah?
Gematria. Oh, so it says like this, is that gematria could mean, is like, what?
There's gematria in the Torah.
Yeah, there's gematrias. Yeah, but I think gematrias are like, just like any other medrash, is that there's ideas, which Chazal reference, and one way to refer to ideas and to reference ideas is through gematria. So it could be like they want to point out a certain concept, and the gematria, you know, underscores that concept.
Like a remez.
Yeah, like a remez to an idea. You know, and maybe, you know, it's a way of bringing out ideas. You know, like a mnemonic, like an asmachta, or that's what I look at it. And if there is one in the Torah, like it could be, it's like there are certain ideas that are referenced in the Torah, so that's, you know, but I don't think anyone uses gematrias to prove the legitimacy of the Torah, you know. But like a gematria, like it's a way of hooking an idea about a parsha, but using gematria, and it's a way to remember it, it's a way, you know, to reference the idea, that kind of thing. You know, but the Torah codes in theory is an attempt to prove the validity, you know, the Torah's divinity. That's why Ishtar uses to go around telling people this is like, at least they did. The Torah's true because look at all this stuff. I think. That's my impression. I don't know that much about it, but look up Torah codes. The wiki Torah codes, I'm sure you'll find it all along. You'll find the arguments about the mathematics. That's what I would just, you know, I just don't really believe this type of thing in general. Especially because it's not in the Zohar. Like, it's in the Masorah, for instance, Tzomer Sinai, that you remember this day, Laman, whatever, Kalayamim, this will be, tell your kids and your grandkids or whatever, the idea of Tzomer Sinai being the event of Sinai, supposedly being an event that will testify to the truth of the Torah. The Torah, so that's in the Torah. But the idea that the Torah is true because of the Torah codes, you know, you just got to be, you know, skeptical when all of a sudden last year someone came up with a new way to indicate the truth of the Torah, you know? But, you know, I don't know.
That's the case also. You should be able to predict it, like,
predicting
every major event that has occurred.
Yeah, I know. I think they may predict things also. I know that's the thing is, you know, just do some double-blind, you know, experiment. Predict something that's going to happen next year, see what happens. I think they probably claim they've done that also.
But they don't tell you about the
movie. Yeah, that's what I'm saying is, you know, with all these things, you know, you have to be skeptical of the methodology that they're having. So my hunch which is totally not researched at all. Just my hunch is that if you actually do this, subject this to a rigorous analysis, it's not going to pan out.
My question, though, isn't so much like, do you use this to prove the Torah? I'm just wondering. Like,
oh, because I'm talking about stuff being encoded in the Torah Yod Gemidos, so you want to know this, is that?
No.
Okay, yeah.
Is there, I could probably think of some other examples, that's just the first one I came to my head. But is there such a thing as like looking, as you mentioned, Tarmi Sinai. So Tarmi Sinai is, as I understand it, the only method to prove the Torah, that the Torah is true. Can you look to these other things and also, as a support and say, this also shows. Not that you improve the Torah's truth from here, but this is like another.
Right,
I understand. I don't know. But you see the Chacham of the Torah also, like, tremendous support.
Right, I once heard another one which is used, I think Chaim Shay told us about this, I'm not sure in what context, but I think it says that, the animals with the Yitusim on them.
Oh.
That's the Simanim, but then it says there's three animals, and only four animals only have one Simanim. Three that have one, and one has the other. And those are also not kosher.
Amal, Arnevis, Shafad, and Chazir.
Right. So the thing is, I think the claim in the Masorah is, just, I don't know if it's not clear in the Patorah that this is the case, but the claim is these are the only ones. No other, it's exhausted, that list. No other examples, and it has only one sin and not the other. And apparently the claim goes to this day that that's still true. This Torah was written 3,300 years ago.
Yeah,
it
could be like coincidental. Evolution didn't bring about another one.
Yes, but I would think if the Torah was written that long ago, these are the only four animals. That's like a pretty big prediction. If one out on a line and said, these are the only four animals in the entire universe that only have one simon and not the other one, there's no way anyone at that time could have known such a thing. And it's why go out on a limb like that and predict that, you're easily falsifiable. And that would be pretty cool. But I just don't know the Torah. If, let's say, for instance, here's my question. If we found the fifth one, would you throw out the Torah? I don't think so. So is it really being honest as a proof then?
Yeah, but that's what I'm asking.
What is it really doing then? So it's not. Then is it really a proof? The Torah doesn't. The reason why you wouldn't throw it out is because the Torah doesn't. I don't think the Torah says that explicitly. It doesn't definitely say it explicitly. Does Masorah say that that's a fact? That's it. And what do you do now if you find the fifth one? Are you convinced that you're not gonna? And if you do, would you say that that's a kasha on Torah? Start doubting it. And if so, then fine. Then I guess if that's the case, but I don't, I feel usually people use these things though aren't honest in that, in that type of thing. If the Torah is really divine and it says that, so then you say, it's Lav Dafka or whatever. So then it's a really good proof anymore. Then it's cool that it works out that way, but yeah, maybe it's just a coincidence. Like, it has to really be like a claim. So I don't know, each one you have to take into some. But I don't know, I haven't looked into that. Maybe the Masorah says that it is, it's a fact. And that's it. And if the Torah Masorah says, if you find the fifth one, then reject the Torah. I doubt it says that, but...
I heard that something similar about Shemitah, and that was like, and how, it was like, how do you know, the Torah is divine? Because it says, you have 7 years to work the land, and in the eighth year, you don't work the land or whatever. And then in Yovel, you have two or three years in a row where you're not working the land. How are you going to eat?
Right.
How can the Torah say that the land's going to go on or whatever? Because God is going to make it that you can go on. That proves that it's the fact that it works out.
Does it?
How would I know?
It's not very good proof for you.
I'm not the guy saying this. I'm just saying. I heard somebody say that.
It's a ridiculous claim.
Saying, did the Jews survive the Shemitah?
I don't know.
I think it's ridiculous because you can just import food from other places.
Sure.
There's a Chazal like that.
No, it's a ridiculous claim to make because if it's not true, because
people are going to die out of it.
Yeah, because it's easily testable.
Right. Here's the thing. I think there's a sheer.
It says that, by the way, I think it says that it will grow anyways, even though you don't like plant or anything.
Right.
Because after 7 years, if it's not true, I'm going to leave Judaism because they see that no plants grew, even though.
Right. The only thing is, they say, well, it must have been their chotem. You know, there's a lot of religions that make claims like that, and they always have excuses when they don't work out. You know? That's why it didn't work out.
There was this movement recently of like all these people that decided that the world was going to end on a certain date.
Mm-hmm.
And they prayed or whatever, and they all got together, and the date came, and obviously nothing happened.
Yeah.
And the lady said, oh, you see, like, you were affected, it worked.
See, that's the problem. The problem with these things, I think, and this reminds me of, you have to check it out. You can listen to Shira. Everyone's give a Shira on Lo Sinasu as Hashem. You shouldn't test God. I think it might be related to this, but I think this, what I'm going to say now might be based on the Shira a little bit, is that the Torah we know is true because of Sinai and because of the Chachma of the Torah, or whatever method the Torah has that we know it's true. Now, if you're going to set up some other method, so you're saying, well, you know, I'm not so sure. Let me just try another method. Or it just like kind of calls, like, are you really calling it into question if you find the fifth species like that? Or is it, like, once you know something is true, like, well, you don't have to find other methods and other methods and other methods and other methods. It's almost like you're not, you know, you're like asking for a sign from God to show you something, you know, for some like supernatural type of, you know, people are seeking out something else. You know, the Torah has a method, then what are you looking for and what are you trying to do? It's like, you know, you don't have to know it's more true. It's true, so it's like you're kind of looking for some super duper verification, which is outside of rationality. It's not reasonable to look further. Reminds me of, it's an interesting one, there's an issur of those, testing a Navi. Like, you're not allowed to test a Navi more. Like, you have to test a Navi up to a point where it's convincing that he's really a Navi. Like, you ask him for signs about the future, you know, and he has to tell you, predict them, and they have to come true exactly to the every single detail. And you have to keep doing it until it's... Yes, and then it's also to keep doing it further. Because, and I guess that point, what that point is, I guess, is based on the Chaman to determine, or you to determine. But the point is like, after that point, you're just looking for magic tricks. Like, there is a rational point at which you want to make sure it's legitimate and he's not just good at guessing or good at predicting things, you know? You know, some people have a good intuition. But beyond that point, then it's just like a person looking for like magic and looking for this supernatural type of mystical appeal. So the Torah itself also, people could oftentimes be looking for this type of an appeal, certain type of an appeal, and that, like, the codes feels to me like that, you know? Like, it's just like this, like, every word is included in, like, it's not really like so much chachma. It's like, what's the idea? Like, the chachma of the, you know, midos is you get the chachma satori involved in Talmud Torah and smaras and ideas. And, like, what's the codes? Okay, it predicted it's like Rabin was going to be assassinated by Galamir. Okay, great. But where does that bring you to? It's just kind of, you just get to know it's true. But you know it's true, right? So what more is it giving you? It's not giving you any ideas, any insight, any anything. You know, so I just feel, it sounds like...
It doesn't really turn into a religious book, it's like...
What's the point? Yeah, what's the point? It just kind of, I feel like it brings you away from Torah and the Chachmas of Torah and into some other, you know? Something like that, you know? Something on that path. But, you know, I don't know. I guess each one has to be taken in.
That's
what we looked into. I'm not... I'm just kind of talking off the cuff, so maybe this is some of these things are genuine. That thing is, I remember Chaim Chay told us that, but I don't know if he's telling us the Torah's like it's a prediction or this or that. You know, I just know I was a little skeptical because it doesn't say that in the Torah, and I just doubt anyone would really throw out the Torah. So that is really good proof. Like I said, like there's something good proof. If you're not going to stick by it as a kasha, if it doesn't turn out, then it's not really very good proof. You know.
I don't know about the one by Ashkenaz. I know by Shmini, doesn't actually say that these are the only four.
No.
It just says,
no.
Here are four that...
Right, I know.
Seven.
Right, I know. You're right, I think. But whatever. Yeah, I don't think... It doesn't say in the Torah anyways. You know, I'm pretty sure it doesn't say that explicitly. Look, it is a way to read the Torah. Because you'll say, why is it only singling these out? It only singles these out as ones only on 7. But, I don't know, maybe it only singles these out because whatever, those are the ones that were common in that time, and whatever, it doesn't mean in the entire universe there's no other animal like that. It could just be, like, what's the story going to tell them about some animal that lives in South Africa, South America or something, that the Jews at that time had no access to? So maybe there is another one in the world, it just didn't list that one, but it told you the general fall, and you could derive it. So, I'm sure that it doesn't seem like it would be that hard to say that if we found one in South America. So now it happens to be there isn't one in South America. They said, that's it, the Torah's true. I mean, you know.
So, I mean, I heard when this was being said, there was something that was like, oh, well, they found like a boar in Indonesia or something that chewed its cud.
Right.
So that should be proof that the Torah is no good.
Right. That, and then they found out that it really does because it's something. I know Slifkin has stuff about this.
I'm saying I just heard that it was awesome.
Doesn't really choose thought. It's a question of what Slifkin means.
I just heard that it was like it doesn't have the right amount of stomachs. It's not the same.
See, yeah, that's only that. It's a question of what does it really mean to choose thought. There's all kinds of hooks and whatever. I don't know. You know, you gotta have these things. But, look, it could be an interesting thing to look into, but I just feel like, you know, when you're looking for this type of stuff, like, Torah has good stuff. Torah Sinai has the Chachmas of Torah. Person gets himself into the Torah, they don't need the stuff anymore. Like, it's kind of the way they try to get by the Shabbat. That's the truth. They should throw it out. And look, maybe there's a place for it to try to get people into the Torah if there's some, you know. It's interesting, it's cool. They go around and do Torah Sinai, they do this, they do that. They do a number of stuff, you know. So, look, maybe it's as a method for the Shabbat. It's just like, people, it's not good to dupe people into things. So, if it's not really legitimate, people are going to end up, you know, when they'll see it doesn't hold water, then they kind of get upset. But you know, check it. I'm sure you Wikipedia. See what the, you know. The codes themselves are interesting. I know there has been a lot of mathematics written on it. It came out with math. I mean, the guy who came out with it was, I think, a mathematician. At least he had a backing of a mathematician. But I think since then there were many mathematicians who went the other way, and probably both. I'm sure there have been on both sides. You know. Yeah, it sounds fishy to me. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? Yeah.
I noticed we're doing some like Tisha B'Av stuff today.
Really? Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
That got me thinking. Like,
I think this year, I'll try and find out for sure. If you want to know.
Yeah, very good.
But I think it was understanding the mitzvos. I think it was. Oh, I had that before. I think it was D283.
Understanding the mitzvos.
284, I mean. I think that's what it is. It's 1 and 2.
It's like some code where it's not like I won't be able to understand it. D283.
Understanding the mitzvos. Okay.
Sounds like it could be that.
You know what?
I'm
just gonna go
in the other room and you'll listen
for just 1 minute.
Oh, okay, great. Right? Yeah, okay. Yeah,
go ahead, Matt. Yeah.
Did you tell me right away? There's D284
and 284.
And it's called Understanding the Mitzvahs.
Understanding the Mitzvahs 1 and 2. I guess there's probably.
Does it have a date when it was? I'm not
sure.
I don't
have a date.
Okay, I don't
think
I ever heard those. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
It's
very
hard. I know. No, well, not from listening to it. I just thought maybe I would remember it, like, live.
Right.
You know, sounds like when I was around.
Oh, you were around the 280s.
I think so.
That was your era, the 280s.
That's
amazing. Right. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, I think my first year in yeshiva was D157. My first one. I'm just kidding. This was my first year. Before she heard it, I always used to do it, Rebbe would say, okay, I think today we're going to do D157. Okay.
Really?
No, I'm kidding. Yeah, okay, get out.
I might switch gears with my question, actually.
Okay.
I have a more controversial question than I was going to ask you before. Is it recording, actually?
Well, no.
Okay, so the question is from Talmud X. The fellows want to know that is there a benefit? What's the benefit of being married? Or is there a benefit other than the sexual benefit? Is that it's hard to be single? Because after all, you could be a dorm guy and have good friends and good companions and life is good. And what's the point of getting married? Is it only purely the sexual? Because a person has sexual needs and is more productive as a human being insofar as he's not frustrating himself? Or is there some other benefits as well? Well, first of all, you have habet peruvu. Does that count? I mean, that's kind of sexual, but that's like the idea of a person being a productive member of the world and contributing towards building the world and building Klal Yisrael and being the furtherance of the... Like, that's the mitzvah of peruvu mo'asar tzivshua. So, I mean, it's the sexual, but it's the sexual is the objective of the sexual. It's a person whose meaning in their life is beyond themselves, but isn't perpetuating the system down to the next generation, having kids, teaching them Torah, passing down, populating the world. That's like the plan of that God's plan in the world. That mitzvah is, it's an important mitzvah. So getting married does that. Like, you're involved in, like they say, like a person who's a gambler is like puzzledus because he's not involved in yeshiva shalala. He's not involved in like doing anything productive. So a person's supposed to be involved and not just the self, although the self is good and it's part of, like growth and learning, and there is time for that, but there's also a part of a person's life where you continue your own growth, but the person should be involved in building the world, contributing to society, and that's done. You can do that by talking to people or whatever, but like it's done a very large way through your children. That's the next generation and you're pushing, So I don't know if that's the answer you're looking for. Is that a sufficient answer? I mean, maybe there's more, but what? Having kids is cool. Yeah. What I'm saying, besides from being cool, it's like a philosophical thing. Both. I mean, it's also a psychological thing. Like, it's, rewarding psychologically. Kids and a wife and a family, it's like a different type of, I mean, that's just on a psychological level, I think. It's, the sexual isn't...
kind of psychological.
You mean sexual includes all the psychological, family, love? Or your question was psychological?
Yeah.
Not philosophical.
So I said benefit, I guess I meant psychological.
Is there any psychological benefit besides for the sexual?
Happier, I guess.
Oh, I understand. Oh, I understand what you mean.
Yeah.
Based on, I don't know if you're there for a case of Shir on when he was talking about, finding a wife.
I listened.
Oh, you listened recently?
Shortly after it was.
Right.
Because he was saying that there's something to be said for going through life.
Oh, right.
Very hard with someone who you can share the experience with. Yeah. That's a very important thing, not to just be alone through the hardships of life.
Yeah, but you could share those experiences with friends at the dorm.
Someone who's you're basically, the puzzle says,
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. There's like a different type of loneliness. I think like a dorm guy is still lonely. Is like, there's a difference of a wife. A wife, or a good wife, it's a different type of a relationship, which, like certain things you won't, you don't share with your friends, you don't live life with your friend. Like, you kind of like a bunch of guys who it's like beneficial to, you're not like partners with your friends, so to speak. It's like, you help each other out and you kind of are in a similar situation, you hang with them. But I feel like your wife, it's like you are navigating life with your wife, and you live your lives together, and it's like, there's a certain type of a companionship, which I would think a single guy has a certain, loneliness. Not lonely because you don't have people to hang out with, but just like you're a loner, so to speak. You live your life as a single.
They don't share the same fate as you.
Yeah, right, the fate in your life. Ultimately, in a certain sense, your wife doesn't either, but that's in, a deeper philosophical sense.
Right.
But, ultimately, even you and your wife are two separate people, and there's no such thing as, you're a loner anyways. But, I think on a cycle, you share each other's joys and pains, and, you care about each other, and in its own case, she cares about you in a deep way. you know, your happiness or sadness is our happiness and sadness, and you kind of, you know, you bond in that type of a way. I think that's like you matter. You really matter to somebody, you know, in a deep way. I think that's the benefit to you. Like, I think psychologically you feel, it just gives you a certain type of a, you know, comfort and a companionship, which you don't really have as being single. Yes. I mean, look, there may be other, you know, negatives. But I'm saying is, in terms of better, yeah, because they still have friends. Like, it doesn't, it's not mutually exclusive.
It's not the same, I feel like.
Oh, yeah. Well, it depends what you mean. I think it is. I see what you mean. You don't hang out with the guys as much anymore? It depends. Not at the beginning. Because, you know, you find the comfort zone where you still do. You do. I mean, it's a good marriage. You can still hang out with your friends. I don't think it's... What?
Like that.
What?
Like once a week, if that, like...
Oh, yeah. I guess. I mean, you're going to get to hang out with the guys. I don't know. I don't think... I don't really know. I don't know if guys miss that. I never heard people complaining, like, I can't, you know. I don't really know. It seems to me it's like, yeah, it's different. It's a deeper type of a hanging out. If you presumably you like your wife, and you like hanging out with her, I mean, I would think. So, like, you know, if you enjoy being with the guys more than with your wife, then, I mean, look, there is a place for both. You know, they don't get the same things from your wife as the guys. But, for instance, like, especially if you're on learning, you hang with the guys, you have chavrusos, and you hang with them, and, you know, you don't necessarily sit around and watch TV with them or something, or whatever you do. But like, you still have, like, your life. Like, I don't think your wife is your life. You know, your wife is your wife. But you still have friends, and you still have rishos, and you still chill, you know, and you have companionship also. I mean, presumably when you're in yeshiva, you can be married, and presumably you're in yeshiva all day, and you're hanging out with your friends, and with the guys, and whatever. So, I guess the hour or two at night, which you're hanging out with the guys, instead you can hang out with your wife. You know, but I think I think it's deeper. I think that's the thing. It's like, it's a deeper type of a relationship, and it could satisfy your, you know, your psyche more than... The hangout with the guys is like maybe like exciting, but I think it's like surface. It doesn't satisfy your deep, you know, your deep psychological needs in the same way. So maybe it's more fun and exciting hanging out with guys. You know, more laughs, more funny stories or something, you know. But I think it's like a more real connection that you have with your wife. And yeah, that's what I think. It's an interesting question, but. And kids are, you know, kids are a big thing also. Kids are fun. I mean, kids are also rough, you know. They're mixed bag, you know. But the kids are also, like, you meet, like, I don't know, I think there's something to, like, psychologically, like, you're loved. You love them, they love you, you're, like, you're meaningful to them. Like, you take on a significance to your, you know, you're important. So it, like, caters to a certain feeling of, like, you know, you mean something to other people. Like, in the dorm, in a certain sense, like, no one really cares about you.
Irreplaceable?
Yeah, sort of, yeah. I mean, I don't mean to be crass or, you know, depressing. But it's, you know, look, I mean, there's such a thing as a good friend, you know? And, like, a good chaver, you know, is, like, you know, that's not the case. You know, but there's such a, like, often time in the dorm is just like, you know.
Friends.
Yeah, it's like situational friends. It's like they're good to hang out with, and you need to hang out with someone or whatever. And, you know, like, I think there's a certain superficiality to it. You know, it doesn't cater to your deep needs because they don't really care for you in that type of way. It's not a deep friendship. There's like a deep, but there is such a thing as deep, you know, as a real a deep friend. You know, as a real, you know, friend where you have a real bond and, you're not replaceable, really, and you do care about each other, and, you know. But I think that you get something from a relationship when you, you know, you truly have, you know, care about each other, you know, and you mean something to each other, as opposed to just like mutually conducive benefit, you know, like, you know, you're easily replaceable, and it's just kind of a convenience thing, and but. Yeah, what do you see as the... But the philosophical thing is something to think about also. I don't think that's, you know, but that wasn't your question.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what are the negative side? How do you see the negative side?
Of what?
Of being married, as opposed to, you mean how you lose that? You lose something. You look at it as you're losing something.
It seems like to me the companionship of like your good friends and everyone is like better than. Maybe you're a long time too. You don't need to always be with them. But like,
want to hang out with them. Right, yeah, I think that's the thing. I think there's like, maybe it's like a certain quantity versus quality point. It's like your friends in the dorm, there's a lot of them, and there's like a lot more laughs and like more exciting, but I think the quality, the depth of the relationship is severely lacking, and I think that's going to be more meaningful to a person psychologically than the more and the, you know. Like, one good friend is better than 10 bad friends, you know? Like, I'm sure you've had experiences, you know? A lot of people have a lot of friends, but they don't have anyone, like, a lot of friends on Facebook, but you never have any real, and like, a deep friend. Like, a deep friend is much more valuable to a person than, I think, than 10 superficial friends. So I think your wife is a different... Yeah.
A related question was, like, did you ever, like, go on vacation with, like, a friend?
Yeah.
And after like 2 or 3 weeks.
Oh, you got sick of them.
Yeah, so like has that not happened with like,
oh, with your wife?
A girl after like.
Oh, I understand.
That's 2-3 weeks. You're with this person for years.
Oh, I understand.
Is this a practical show?
That was actually the question. Like, how do you not get fed up with the person? Yeah. After you're
we were venting anxiety.
Oh, I understand. Right. So this is a good question. I mean, I guess Hilz Nida helps for that. That's what Chazal say. You know, Chazal say something like that.
Really?
Yeah, that, you know, it's like a, like you're getting remarried every month or something. Chazal, I think it's Chazal like that. It's like the idea of, it's the sexual component, but that's, you know.
It is.
Yeah, it's like, it's like waves, in a certain sense. If you had a friend who that would be the case, you're on vacation, you take off, and you know, it's like, that friend who you get sick of, you need a little space. So it's not, you know, you still live with your wife, but like the relationship does have different, you know, different like modes, you know, which it oscillates. What? Yeah, right. That's why I don't think really most marriages or good marriages involve like spending so much time with your spouse, like always, you know. Just not, you're right, it's not reasonable. Like, you're talking about you go on vacation with the person and you're like, momish, the two of you for a week, it is 24/7 with each other. I don't think that's the way marriages go. I mean, maybe the first week when you get married, if Shev Brachos it is, but like, you know, you have your life. So, like, you have your chavrusas, you do your thing, like, maybe you hang out at night and whatever for, you know, for an hour or two or whatever, and you eat your meals with her, and, you know, but, you know, I don't know. I think it's because...
Not as much time?
Not as much time.
As the vacation.
Yeah, I think vacation is like a very intense type of a thing.
Don't go on vacation.
But, well, yeah, the thing is like, I think the challenge of marriage is because you're two people. And this only happens on vacation. It's like you, two people with different wants and different needs and different desires, and it creates conflict. Sometimes I want to go here, I want to go there, and you kind of start fighting over these little petty things. Like, and that's what I think that's my experiences on those vacations. What happens is, it's like you just kind of certain small clashes become like magnified. You know, is that what you're thinking of, or no? Or you don't know?
Yeah.
We haven't had
frustration.
Generally,
you're sick. Yeah, yeah. So. No.
Why are you in the room right now?
You're right, you want space. Yeah, I guess a good marriage knows how to give each other space, though. I mean, that's part of working things out, you know? Like, you're not on top of each other all the time. Vacation isn't a good idea, because you're, like, isolating yourself from the whole world, and it's just the two of you, and, like, you know, doing everything together. And yeah, I think it's also, it could be sexual also helps, you know? And, like, I don't know. Not really sure. I've only been married once, so it hasn't happened to me. But I don't know that it doesn't happen to people. You know, so I don't have I'm not sure if I could say why it doesn't happen. Maybe it does. But I don't know. I don't think it does. I don't think it should. But I don't know why exactly it doesn't and why it does, you know. It's a good question why that does happen with your friend. If you really have a good friend, why would it be that? You know, why should that happen? It's a little bit strange. Like, what? Yeah. Like, if you enjoy their companionship, you know, being with them, so what happens there? What is that? What is that altogether?
I get sick of being in a group of lots of people
all the time. Yeah, I mean, these things have to be analyzed. You know, but just because it happens with a friend doesn't mean it's going to happen with your wife. You have to figure out why does it happen with your friend.
I was going to say, is there something in terms of the difference in gender, or?
Well, there's something in terms of that. Yeah, so that's something. Yeah. No, I mean, it could be, it's like, yeah, the sexual dimension changes everything. It could be that's the answer, but I don't know. It's interesting why that does happen with your friend. You know, I'm not sure. That's a more interesting question, I think. And then once you get a good answer to that, it could be what you go see why it doesn't happen with your wife.
I was just saying possibly, because even when you have a really good friend, you both still have certain like emotional position, like I would say, that don't quite match up.
Right.
And these don't come out usually, but also you have another quality of like intense familiarity with the other person.
Right.
And when that crosses a certain border, then those emotional positions will interfere. And doesn't really interact in a more subdued, separated fashion.
So again, what's the clash?
Meaning you both have certain like emotional dispositions that don't necessarily show themselves when you just interact. And
you know, that's true. That's true. I mean, that's the challenge. I think that's the biggest challenge in marriage, is that you have these things, these hang-ups, and if they clash, your hang-ups and our hang-ups clash, then you got problems. I mean, you have problems, but you got to work them through. I mean, that often happens. You really want to do something, and she really wants to do the other thing. And you both feel strongly about it, you know? And it could be from anything, it could be silly things, but just like some, you just are used to doing things a certain way. And why? I don't know, you just are. And it's not, it just somehow, these things are meaningful to you sometimes, you know? And if she's used to doing it a different way, then you kind of have to just figure out what you're going to do.
It's like the vacation motion. Like, you guys want to do two different things that day.
Yeah, right, exactly.
You can either get frustrated with each other and hate each other.
Yeah, right.
You work it out, then you
can
do that day.
Right. Right. Like, I remember, I think, like, when I grew up, we used to keep batteries in the fridge. I don't know why, but we just did. But at least it didn't. So we had to figure out what we were going to do. I don't think it was a big fight, but I think I had to get over the fact that we're not going to keep batteries in the fridge. It didn't, you know? It's just, like, a silly example, but, like, it's just, like, you do, like, you know? Things like this exist, so you have 1,000 things that you live alone, you're your own person, you do things the way you want to do things. And now all of a sudden, you know, when you want to go to sleep, you go to sleep. When you want to go whatever it is, you want to watch this TV show, you want to do this, you want to do that, you want to put your batteries in the fridge, you know, you just do what you want to do. That's just kind of the way you do it. Now you get married and you have to all of a sudden take into account another person, and you have to compromise a lot. You know, and you have to learn when, you know, I think a good marriage, you should both, the general klal, I think, for these things is you got to figure out who feels more strongly about the thing and let that person win. You know, because sometimes it doesn't matter. Like, I didn't really care. You know, you have to know if one person really wants batteries in a certain place and another person doesn't really care, then you got to figure out, you know. The problem is sometimes you both do care, you know, then it's all right, and then it's tricky. You know, but it's a kind of, you know, it takes time to adjust, to learn how to find to be koveya new patterns, which are together patterns, you know. You have to, like, change your life from being living alone to living with somebody. So it's kind of you have to forge new paths, you know, resolve these types of things. But I think it's good. I think it's a good type of thing for a person, because it kind of gets you to be a little bit more, it's good to work on your emotions like that, you know?
Right.
You end up being able to be less rigid in the way you do things and more open-minded and more compromising, and, you know, you overcome different, like, you know, hang-ups, brings out certain issues that you have, and, you know, I think overall it helps you to be able to do things like that. That's what they say. I think Rabbi told us once, the greatest v'hatarach kamocha is with your wife. It's like a certain chesed, appreciation of another human being. and being able to work with them and get over your own pettiness and your own emotions, and you know, it's like a good you know, vehicle of doing that. And if you have a good wife, then you could really, you know. Yeah, I think it's good. I think it's really good, worth it. You know, I'm gonna think into it some more, maybe to have more, you know, thought it more cogent. You know. Yeah, yeah.
Thoris doesn't do it.
Thoris doesn't do it, yeah. No, it's true, though. I think that thing is that deep, the deep bond, the deep companionship, the deep friendship.
The question is, like, how are you going to pass up, like, fun times in the dorm, like, hanging out with one person?
Yeah.
Where you're probably not even, like, as good of friends as people. I guess you're saying it's a better companionship than that.
Yeah, right. It's better and it's deeper. You're just thinking of, like, a girl you go out on 3 dates with or something, and, you know? But yeah, you really feel strongly for your wife. You know, it's different. You know? Yeah.
It's pretty fun.
Someone hasn't lived before.
It's pretty fun. Yeah, no, I know what you mean. Yeah, like the thing is, there's a certain comfort level also with your wife, which is totally, you know. Like, now you think of girls as being, like, anxiety and the whole parsha, and, you know, it's like, yeah, there's a comfort level which you can't have with your friends. You could be yourself. I think that Pesach Shir was about that. Someone who you could really be yourself, who you, you know, you could really be comfortable with who you are, and you feel like you don't have anything to hide, you don't really have to hide your nature, and, you know, you kind of be, you know, like, really let yourself show. You know, whereas opposed to, like, in the world, you kind of live in a certain, right, if I remember correctly, something like that. You live in a certain sense, you don't fully let yourself out. You don't let your guard down. So there's something to, like, you let someone into your inner circle, and you live together, and... Yeah. Let me think about it more, though. It's a good question. But my, yeah, my surface answer is that it's worth it, but, you know. Yeah. Okay, so I will stop here.